Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Nate Cardozo of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who explains why his group has filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit to obtain documents about possible illegal conduct by U.S. intelligence agencies. Mazen Kosia, a Palestinian-American activist, who describes the upsurge in repression of Palestinians living under Israeli occupation in the West Bank and his view of an appropriate American response. And David Carries, professor of constitutional law, who examines the issues of race and class seen in the confrontation between Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Cambridge police officer James Crowley. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The British human rights group Global Witness has accused foreign mining companies of fueling ongoing political violence in the eastern section of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The DRC is rich with minerals like tin, gold, coltan, and tungsten. Global Witness says the mines for the valuable metals are controlled by rival militia groups from the Congolese army. The militias have been charged with using the revenues from these mines to fight a bloody 12-year civil war. Human rights monitors say these militias have participated in the killing of unarmed civilians, rape, torture, and recruitment of child soldiers. Western and Asian buyers of Congo minerals go through third-party traders in Rwanda and Burundi, which often fail to check out the sources of these metals. Among the large Western metal buyers is UK-based Amalgamated Metal Corporation and various Belgian firms. In its report, Global Witness calls for United Nations sanctions against companies that fail to vet the identity of all trading intermediaries. Specifically, the British human rights group alleges Amalgamated Metals Corporation got its tin supply from a mine controlled by the Hutu rebel group, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Rwanda, whose leadership has been implicated in the 1994 Rwanda genocide. Amalgamated Metals denies the charge. In a major legislative victory for President Obama, the Senate eliminated funding for seven new F-22 stealth jet fighters by a surprising 58-40 vote. President Obama had threatened to veto the military spending bill unless the F-22 funding was deleted. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates campaigned against the new F-22 fighters, calling it outmoded. Instead, Gates is pushing for production of smaller F-35 fighters for use in military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. According to Slate, the Pentagon has built 187 F-22s at a cost of $60 billion, fighter jets originally designed to penetrate the Soviet Union. So far, no F-22 fighter has been used in combat. Senators Carl Levin and John McCain led the effort to cut the F-22 funding, while a bipartisan coalition led by Senators Saxby Chambliss and Chris Dodd sought to preserve the funds for more fighter jets. The vote was the first time in 30 years that Congress had killed a major existing weapons program. In 1977, President Jimmy Carter temporarily halted the B-1 bomber. But the fighter jet was revived by the Air Force a year later with a new mission to launch long-range cruise missiles. U.S. Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar has placed a temporary ban on staking new uranium claims near the Grand Canyon. The move was praised by environmentalists seeking to put the Grand Canyon off limits for uranium mining. Activists fear that uranium prospecting could contaminate the watershed of the iconic national park. Last year, the House Natural Resources Committee passed a bill to prohibit new uranium mining claims in the Grand Canyon, but it was ignored by the Bush administration. In northern New Mexico, the Navajo Nation and environmentalists have gone to federal court to stop a new uranium mine that was licensed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Joe Shirley, president of the Navajo Nation, told The Nation magazine, "I don't believe there is any safe technology that can be used to mine uranium. Many people have died because of mining uranium ore here on Navajo land." From 1950 to 1970, Navajos worked in hundreds of uranium mines in northwest New Mexico that became a major production point for uranium. The industry collapsed after the Three Mile Island nuclear accident. The abandoned uranium mines have left a toxic legacy in Navajo country. At the Homestake Mill Superfund site, mining tailings contain 20 million tons of radioactive sludge. In addition, radioactive material has leached into the groundwater, and water wells near the Superfund site have been ordered closed. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
On July 22nd, the Electronic Frontier Foundation filed a lawsuit under the Freedom of Information Act to demand documents from the CIA, FBI, NSA, and Departments of Homeland Security, Defense, Energy, and State. The suit, filed in a San Francisco federal court, asks for misconduct reports that could reveal illegal or unconstitutional activities carried out under the 8 years of the Bush administration. Presidential orders require that U.S. spy agencies report illegal action to the Intelligence Oversight Board, created in 1976, which could then refer potential crimes to the president or the attorney general. However, in a February 2008 executive order, President Bush reassigned the power of the board to investigate over to the National Intelligence Director. Members of Congress have recently made public complaints that the CIA and other intelligence agencies had not kept them informed about controversial programs undertaken by the Bush administration. Democratic Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi has contradicted statements by the CIA that she had been briefed about waterboarding techniques used against U.S.-held prisoners. Press reports allege that former Vice President Dick Cheney had ordered the CIA not to reveal to Congress details about the agency's covert assassination squad targeting al-Qaeda operatives. The House Intelligence Committee has recently launched an investigation into the lack of information coming to Congress about the CIA death squad, warrantless domestic surveillance, torture of prisoners, and the destruction of videotape recordings of harsh interrogations. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Nate Cardozo, Open Government Legal Fellow with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who explains why his group initiated the Freedom of Information lawsuit and the prosecutions that could result from making any intelligence agency lawbreaking public.
The end goal of the lawsuit that I helped file with EFF is sunshine and openness in government and intelligence oversight. The intelligence agencies of the federal government are required by executive order to report questions that they have regarding the legality of their acts to a body called the Intelligence Oversight Board. And the goal of this Freedom of Information Act lawsuit is to make those reports public, to get the intelligence agencies questions about their own potential misconduct out in the light of day so that the American people can see what the President and what Congress, hopefully, have been able to see about our intelligence activities over the last 8.5 years.
Certainly, there's been a lot of information flowing out either through press reports or leaks about the misconduct of the Bush administration, war on terror in particular, eavesdropping, torture, and the like. Is there any particular misconduct that you are after in this lawsuit?
No, nothing in particular. EFF's mission is surrounds the internet and technology and the intersection of the internet and democracy. So we are particularly interested in things like electronic surveillance, wiretapping, data mining, things like that. But our FOIA request goes much broader than that. It goes to any misconduct that the intelligence agencies have self-reported. We're really interested in things we don't know about. I mean, we know about the NSA's warrantless wiretapping. We're more interested in things that have been reported in the press as other intelligence activities. We don't really know what that is, and we'd like to find out.
What can you tell us about the Intelligence Oversight Board and how it's been capable of oversight or incapable of fulfilling those duties?
Well, it's interesting how little I can tell you about the Intelligence Oversight Board or the IOB. We don't know very much about it at all. It's a civilian board appointed by the president and serves at the president's pleasure. And it's the primary mechanism for intelligence oversight within the executive branch. The inspectors general of every intelligence agency within the government are required to file reports with the IOB, it used to be quarterly, of any time they had questions regarding their conduct. The IOB reviewed the reports and then either forwarded them to the Attorney General if they felt that that was appropriate, or to the President, or to the Director of Central Intelligence, who became the Director of National Intelligence. The members of the IOB are drawn by the President from civilian life, aren't necessarily people with any intelligence background. And interestingly, President Obama has not appointed anyone to the IOB, so it currently sits empty. So determining whether it's functioning at all is another goal of the lawsuit that we filed. We filed these requests long before we knew anything about Dick Cheney's involvement in CIA activities. The requests, however, would cover such information. And the request under the Freedom of Information Act to the intelligence agencies now is all the more important. If the intelligence agencies have been less than forthright with Congress, then the IOB is really all that's left in terms of intelligence oversight. If the intelligence agencies had any questions about a secret program to assassinate foreign leaders was legal, and it seems like there probably were some people within the intelligence community who had such questions, those questions would have been lodged with the Intelligence Oversight Board. So even if Congress didn't know about it, and apparently Congress was kept in the dark until just last week or the week before about that secret program, there was supposed to be some intelligence oversight going on. And if that board was doing its job, it would be interesting to know if they forwarded those reports on to the Attorney General and what the Attorney General did with those reports.
Just one last note here, though. Do you feel that if you do get a lot of this information and illegal conduct is revealed, could it be the basis for prosecution that has not yet occurred to date because of the public revelations?
You know, anything's possible. It would be the Attorney General's prerogative to do that. Obviously, the Electronic Frontier Foundation is not in a position for criminal prosecution. But hopefully it would spark at least discussion among Congress and the intelligence community regarding why this stuff wasn't prosecuted in the first place. But, you know, anything's possible.
That was Nate Cardozo, Open Government Legal Fellow with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Contact the foundation by calling area code 415-436-9333 or visit their website at EFF.org. The Obama administration has made resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict a high priority and has publicly criticized Israel for its continued settlement building in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem, lands that were taken in the 1967 Arab-Israeli War. But the U.S. has not withdrawn or threatened to withdraw any of the more than $3 billion in mostly military aid it provides to Israel every year. While attacks and oppression of Palestinians by Israeli military forces and settlers have been an ongoing fact of life, there are some indications that such violence is now on the rise. Israeli response to protests against the separation wall being constructed inside Palestinian territory in Belin and other Palestinian villages have turned more violent, resulting in at least two recent killings and the kidnapping of village youths. In another recent incident, 1,500 olive trees, a mainstay of Palestinian agriculture and economic survival, were recently destroyed by settlers. Mazen Kumsia is a Palestinian with dual American citizenship who spent many years in the U.S., but who moved back last year to live at his family home in Beit Sahur in the West Bank. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Kumsia, a professor at Bethlehem University, who describes the upsurge in repression and what he views as an appropriate American response.
So, yes, here in the West Bank, we did observe an increased number of and intensity of attacks of the Israeli colonial settlers in the West Bank on civilians, on Palestinian civilians. And we saw them burning over 1,500 trees in the Nablus area, a few dozen more in another area, and then also attacking Palestinian residents and Palestinian homes. So we did see an increase in the number and intensity of these attacks, and the settlers argue that this is in response to the Israeli government caving in to Obama's pressure, but we don't see actually any of this, that the U.S. administration is putting any pressure on the Israeli government or that the Israeli government is changing any of its policies in the West Bank. The Israeli government is doing the opposite, actually. The Israeli government is intensifying the settlement activities in the West Bank, and what I heard last is that they have made a deal with the Obama administration to continue building 2,500 units for Jewish settlers on Palestinian land.
Right. I heard that the agreement was supposed to be if they could build those, they wouldn't build any more.
That's what we have heard last year and the year before and for the 42 years before that, that it will be just let us build another few thousand here, a few thousand there, and this will be the end of it. But the reality of it, as we know that just from statistics released today, that the number of settlers in the West Bank has exceeded 550,000 people, 304,000 in areas of the West Bank outside East Jerusalem, and then another 250 or so in the areas of East Jerusalem.
You've been critical of the leadership of both Hamas in Gaza and the Fatah-controlled Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. How do you see those two factions?
I really have very mixed feelings about this because I really don't like some of the actions that they are doing. But on the other hand, they are under occupation, and really I'm not in their shoes to decide what actions they have done or have not done that are appropriate. I do believe that both of them have made huge mistakes and have really not served the Palestinian cause in the long run. And I hope for better leadership for the Palestinians. But having said that, I don't mean in any way to give Israel a blank check for what it has been doing, because as I said, these Palestinians are not really an authority in that sense, and remain, you know, people who are prisoners. And so when prisoners elect a tough guy like Hamas to represent them, or they elect a more moderate prison representative like Fatah, who will be more accommodating to the occupation, then, you know, that's what happens. But it doesn't absolve Israel from having to observe international law or human rights. And that's where the focus should be on what Israel is doing, because it's violating international law, violating human rights, and is engaging in war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Mazen Qumsia, given the situation we have now, where Israel is painting the relationship with the U.S. as perhaps the worst it's ever been, and at the same time, things seem to be getting worse for the Palestinians, what do you see as the way forward?
Well, I think each of us should work on the government that they have. I, as a Palestinian now living in the West Bank, should be working on the Palestinian representation, etc. I used to live in the U.S., and I used to work a lot on the U.S. government. And I think Americans who are listening to your show should be working on the U.S. government, not worrying about what the Israeli government or Palestinian so-called authorities or prisoners in the West Bank and Gaza have to represent themselves. The U.S. government can make peace in the Middle East within a month if they choose to. It's the U.S. government that funds Israel to the tune of $3 to $5 billion every year and protects Israel from international law by using the veto power at the United Nations and so forth and so on. And this is contrary to U.S. public interest. It's contrary to the interests of the U.S. economy, and has caused the U.S. economy to deteriorate to where it is now because of the support for Israel and engaging on wars on behalf of Israel, like the war in Iraq and things like that. So I really think the U.S. public would do well to pay attention to their own interests and not worry about what Palestinians have or don't have for leadership, or what Israelis have or don't have for leadership.
That was Mazen Qumsia, a Palestinian-American activist. He is the author of Sharing the Land of Canaan and is writing a forthcoming book on Palestinian civil resistance. Visit his website at qumsia.org. Issues involving race continue to be one of America's most stubborn triggers of hatred and conflict. Even as the nation celebrated the historic inauguration of its first African-American president in January. Questions involving reverse discrimination were the central focus of inquiry during Judge Sonia Sotomayor's Senate Supreme Court confirmation hearings, with white firefighters from New Haven, Connecticut, who testified that they were being victimized by being blocked from advancement even after passing a promotional test, after the results were thrown out. The July 16th incident between Harvard University professor Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Cambridge, Massachusetts police officer James Crowley set the stage for the latest national debate and media circus on the issue of race. Professor Gates, arriving back at his home after a trip to China, found his front door jammed. When Gates and his cab driver broke a screen door to gain entry into the professor's home, a neighbor called police to let them know that a burglary might be in progress. Upon arriving at the scene, Crowley questioned Gates, and a confrontation followed, causing Crowley to call for backup. Gates was arrested for disorderly conduct, but charges were later dropped. While the specifics of what the two men said to each other are in dispute, it's clear that the long history of racial profiling by American police affected the outcome of this encounter. During his July 22nd press conference, President Obama answered a question about the Gates incident by stating that the Cambridge police acted stupidly in arresting somebody when there was already proof that they were in their own home, words that he later backed away from. Obama, Gates, and Crowley planned to drink a beer together at the White House to symbolically bury the hatchet and close out the affair. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with David Carries, professor of constitutional law at Temple Law School and a leading civil rights attorney who examines the issues of racial profiling and class seen in the Gates-Crowley incident.
It wasn't that this officer is a Ku Klux Klan guy who uses the N-word or anything like that. I think it was a combination of big issues about the police that no one is quite talking about that really are independent of race. Because whether or not they arrest him after they find out that he, in fact, it's his home and he's come home from this trip and he's upset, whether or not they arrest him seems to be, in that sense, the major issue. And there's been fighting actually about the scope of disorderly conduct and crimes like that, disturbing the peace. There are lots of Supreme Court cases on it that mostly say, just because a person is disrespectful or talks back or doesn't immediately do everything an officer wants, particularly in the person's own home, is not an allowable basis. Even if it does meet the statutory definition, it would violate his constitutional rights. And the police seem to be saying, we control the streets, we even control the houses to some extent, and if someone shows disrespect to us or doesn't do what we think they need to do when we think they need to do it, that makes it criminal. This is really a central issue all over the world about what we mean by freedom. It's interesting to me to see the conservative side that is talking about freedom all the time, but don't seem to be much concerned about Professor Gates's freedom. Again, that would be independent of race. But then, of course, the way all of us perceive the issue, including Professor Gates and the officer, Crowley, can't be independent of race.
What is it about police departments' relationship with African Americans, minorities in general, that a lot of these white legislators, as well as commentators on the radio and these right-wing talk shows, don't get? Because they seem to think there's some kind of level playing field out there in terms of the police treatment of whites and minorities are identical.
One of the things that this conservative dominance, particularly about law and legal ideas in the last three decades, has done is to basically define racism as what I've been calling the Ku Klux Klan use of the N-word. And anything short of that is not racism. And simultaneously, they've latched on to something good that's happened. I mean, somewhere around World War II or thereafter, racism became wrong. So there's just so much contortion and denial in these things that I think are just deeply embedded in the culture. And so to me, the nomination process, since all this race stuff came up around Sotomayor, the Gates thing, both were just great moments for somebody like Obama, who's so good at this, to talk about it like he did in that Philadelphia speech during the campaign. But perhaps they've got their hands too full. Perhaps they can't step back and think that way yet. But those were two of the times where we could have tried to get at some of this and say, well, maybe just ending discrimination, you know, wasn't enough, the worst kinds of discrimination, and removing it from the law, the explicit forms of discrimination, wasn't enough. And, you know, we could have had a good discussion.
Professor Carey's beyond the issues of race, in this case involving Professor Henry Louis Gates, what about the issues of class? Here you have an elite Harvard professor versus a blue-collar cop on the beat. How much do you think class entered the picture here in this confrontation?
Again, it's like race. It couldn't help but enter and be combined, you know, class and race. Who is this, you know, intellectual who gets paid to do, you know, very little by the policeman standard and doesn't work as hard and doesn't take as much risks and has had advantages or is presumed to have had advantages? And then if you throw in, and this black intellectual, how dare he yell at me, you know? Whereas, again, it's layers of empathy and of understanding. Whereas once he found out this is the way race could subtly, I don't know that this happened, but it's possible. Once he found out that Gates lives there, he's an elderly man, he walks with a cane, he came home from a long trip, he could have wound up in his mind thinking, perhaps, and more likely if it were a white professor, thinking, well, you know, this guy's letting off steam. He just had this trip. It is his house, and I'm invading his house. And really, there's no problem here. I'll walk away.
But he chose to do the other thing.
And I think you're right. Class played a role, as well as race.
That was David Carey's, professor of constitutional law at Temple University Law School. He is the author of the new book titled Philadelphia Freedom, Memoir of a Civil Rights Lawyer. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.